You're listening to the Plain Label Podcast. Hello and welcome back to the Plain Label Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Williams, and in this episode, we continue Horror Fest 2019 with a look at the original and remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street. Here once again, this episode is Mr. Cameron Rice.
Hello, hello.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that we are still proud members of the Deliberate Noise Network. Search Deliberate Noise in your podcast app for more great shows from the network. Let's do a little drink roll call. Cameron, what are you imbibing this evening?
It's a little early. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon where I'm at. So I'm having a very simple light beer. Just a very simple Blue Moon.
Oh, nice. That's nice. So I'm going with, I tried to think of something like Elm Street related, and I couldn't really come up with something that had Elm in it. So the closest
maybe you could go Fireball Whiskey, maybe.
Yeah, really. So the closest I came up with that I had is peach, because I was thinking trees, and so I have some peach tea and some vodka. So
I like that. That works. I like that.
Yeah, there you go. So all right, so let's go ahead and kick off our discussion. We're gonna go it chronologically, because that would make the most sense. And we're starting in 1984 with the original A Nightmare on Elm Street.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
You can just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Peter!
Is the coroner got to say?
He's in the jaw and puking since he saw it.
They're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy?
There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails,
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me!
Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
And the IMDb plot synopsis, Cameron, this is a doozy, and I want you to give me your first blush reaction of this synopsis before we talk about the film. And it goes like this. In the early 1980s, a psychopath named Fred Krueger, known as the Springwood Slasher, murdered several children with a glove outfitted with a straight razor blade, singular, attached to the fingers, plural. When a foolish decision by a judge sets Krueger free, an angry mob of parents whose children he terrorized and murdered burn Krueger alive, misspelling Krueger each one of these times, by the way, in the boiler room where he worked. Years after his death, the living children of the parents responsible for Krueger's death, including Nancy Thompson, daughter of police officer who arrested Krueger, experience terrifying nightmares involving a burned man wearing a glove with razor blades on his fingers. The ghost of Fred Krueger haunts their dreams, and when Nancy's best friend Tina dies violently in her sleep during a dream confrontation with Krueger, Nancy realizes she must find a way to stop the evil psychopath's reign of terror or never sleep again.
Man, there's a lot in there.
A lot going on.
I think the major thing is, the singular blade. Not true. also, man, it feels like there's a lot of preamble of stuff that's not in the movie.
Yeah, a lot of parent talk there.
A lot of parent talk about you would think if you read that the first 45 minutes was the trial.
Yeah, you would think that maybe you've got the judge that's got some sort of grudge against someone or something.
Yeah, you would think there's something going on there. You think there's a lot happening there.
Yeah, John Saxon and Ronnie Blakely have very large roles.
Yeah, you would think that. I think, yeah, there's a couple of things happening. The other thing to me is the fact that the film is kind of – I mean, obviously now, this is the thing about when you do so many sequels is that the mystery is gone. But if you watch that first film, it's almost – it's similar to the first Matrix where you're kind of watching it, and there's supposed to be a degree of what is going on, why, and how.
Mm.
So for IMDb to be like, here's the why and how.
Yeah, which is weird. That's definitely a you know, watching it in retrospect kind of a situation where it's like, well – here's all of the backstory that we got years later or that we got in the remake, definitely. And I'm going to put it upon this first film.
Whereas, yeah, the original film, it's all about like there's a guy in a hat. He's mysterious. Who is this? And it's like, I got a name. I got a name. It's Fred Krueger. And the parents are like, who?
I like how literally in this review, he spells Krueger K-R-U-E-G-R, and then he also spells it K-R-U-G-E-R, and he goes back and forth.
Well, you don't have time to Google it.
He's got no...
You got to write this review. This is not even a review. This is a synopsis.
You got to get it up there. The fans are clamoring for it. I also like the introduction of the Springwood slasher, which is vital in this film. That's what Fred Krueger was known by.
Yeah, that doesn't come up for some time. I don't think that's said till... Is it 3 or 4? But it's... And one of the latter sequels, for right. sure, that's the nom de plume.
And they failed to mention the, what is it? What is it that you love? That
Bastard Son of a Thousand Maniacs.
There it is, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not in there.
That's right. They didn't put
they don't got time.
So this is a franchise that we've discussed before. We've discussed part 3, I think. I feel like a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's one of your favorites. That's one that I feel like... watching this original that I have a lot it warmed me to part 3 even more watching this original one again, because you watch this one and I think about part 3 and I think about how part 3 has more elaborate deaths. I feel like more like chilling deaths, like that whole
you get more elaborate deaths. There's also moments that are very clearly because Nancy's back that you're doing just the way the camera moves, where when Nancy first enters the dream in part 3 and Freddy Krueger, the Freddy worm, sees that it's her, the camera does this kind of the Spielberg Jaws Dolly-in shot onto Nancy when she goes, oh my God. So it's like there's moments built into part 3 that are supposed to be like sequel callbacky, holy crap kind of things.
Yeah, and you get a little bit of the comedy that he's known for in the sequels.
Yeah, part 1, he's not really funny. Like, he's mischievous, but he's not the character that when people think of Freddy Krueger, they usually are thinking of part 3 and 4 because those did the most box office. Mm-hmm. They're not usually thinking necessarily. They might think of the deaths of part 1, but not the personality in part 1.
Yeah, because he does have a couple of things where, you know, he's cutting off his finger just to show that he sort of can't be hurt or that he's crazy or whatever. And then he cuts open his side and all of the worms or the maggots or whatever fall out of there. And he's got a couple of things where it's just sort of like you're finding your way along the character kind of in this first one. So rewatching this time, what did you think? Like, was this something where you watched it and you're like, yep, absolute classic still, like loved every part of it. Everything played just as good as I thought it was going to.
For me, it's still a warm blanket. There's a thing about this movie. Because also when you now know all that went into making it or trying to make it, Wes Craven had the script for a long, quite a while. Not like all the way back to the Hills Have Eyes days, but like, you know, like a couple of years, and every studio turned him down. Every studio was like, nope. And he basically talked about that the main note he got again and again and again was, well, it's dreams, so it's not actually scary. The minute people know it's dreams, it's not scary. It's not scary. And it was finally New Line Cinema, who at that point, New Line was, you know, like Freddy Krueger was sort of known as New Line was the house that Freddy had built, is what it was called. Because New Line Cinema up to that point was essentially a distribution company. Like they brought on other people's films, or they showed other films. If you read about New Line Cinema and Bob Shea, pretty like interesting dude in that it was like, oh, he would go to New York, find out which films' copyrights had lapsed, and get the copyright and then start showing them at like midnight screenings and stuff like that. And he was like really instrumental in early John Waters days. Like he distributed Pink Flamingo and things of that nature. Nightmare on Elm Street was like the second film that New Line had decided to produce and try and get into the production of. So for Bob Shea, it was like finding the script, finding Wes Craven. Everyone else had turned the script down, and Bob Shea was like, okay, yeah, sure, we can do it, but you're only going to get so much money. And there's a lot of stories about in the production of this movie that New Line would run out of money, so everyone worked for free for a week, which everyone, because they believed in the project and they believed in Wes Craven, so they stayed on and all this other stuff. And that's all stuff that's like outside of the movie. But once you know that, it's kind of impressive how much they were able to do.
Well, absolutely.
And what they were able to do. Because you look at like, there is, especially the 80s, there is so many cheap horror movies that are just down to the last dollar that don't look good, that don't hold up. The acting is rough. And I think for the most part, everything in Nightmare still really works. Like, it's easy to kind of nitpick or pick apart, like, oh, this effect or that effect, like the arms extending in the alleyway where it's like, oh, it's very clearly giant springs and stuff like that and so on. But I think there's also something to it that adds, because of the what the film is, which is he's a nightmare demon, you're able to go with it better. The fact that the script plants it all out like a mystery, the fact that you get to like Nancy, but you understand the other characters, the dynamic, and then also the fact that like Freddy Krueger, how he's able to do what he does is kind of explained, but not overly explained.
Mm-hmm.
It's this thing happened and now he's out for vengeance. And we're like, great, we get it. He's a fairy tale creature. Totally understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I guess going back to when I first watched this movie, this was the movie that sort of introduced me to horror. This is something that it came out in 84, but I watched it in, I believe, like 86 or so when I was 7 or 8. And my cousins introduced it to me. And my one cousin is a big comic book guy and a big horror movie guy. And so he sort of helped shepherd me along on both. And I remember watching this when we were over at their house and then driving home, and I was fucking freaked out. And I was, you know, this little 7 or 8 year old kid watching this movie about not falling asleep. And then I'm going back on this big car ride back home, and it's, you know, a good 5 or 6 hours. And I remember thinking, like, what the fuck did I just watch? You know, what's going on? Like, you know, and just not having any sort of frame of reference to anything up until that point in terms of horror movies. And I thought that part of what made it scary was that it, since it was a dream, all of the effects, watching it this time, all of the effects work perfectly well because it's not completely sensical like how your dreams are. You know, Freddy can do things you can't do in the real world.
There's not really crazy effects in the normal world. Kind of the only one maybe is like the bed sheet, and they did that with reverse photography. And that also because it is like this weird nightmare thing, even though he's not in the dream world, there's still something that makes all that work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was kind of my introduction to the film. So I figured, going back to last episode, my kid's 11. She'll watch this movie and she'll be fine. And because she's dabbling into the adult horror and so I put this on and we watched this a couple nights ago, and there was a couple times where she would say, whoa, or that sort of thing, but she didn't find it particularly scary. She liked the movie. She said that she enjoyed it. But there was scenes like at the beginning when Tina is kind of running in a dream, sort of half asleep sort of run, is what the way I explained it to her after the movie was over. And she's like, well, she was just running so goofy. And I was like, yeah, but you know, you ever have a dream where you like can't move or can't run like you would normally would? And she's like, well, not really. It's like, okay, well, you're 11. You don't know anything. You don't know anything. It's perfect. So she wasn't really that scared of the film, but she enjoyed the movie just overall. Like, she doesn't have any problems with 80s acting or the effects of the 80s or anything like that. She thought that the Tina death was the most striking to her, that and Johnny Depp. She did point out, which I hadn't thought of, about the Stranger Things connections again with Nancy, you know, with using the same name, and then with Johnny Depp's character looking like Steve from Stranger Things, even though the names are different. And I was like, she goes, oh, look, it's like Nancy and Steve, but it's
Glenn. Well, you have that, and then you also have Freddy pressing against the wall, which Stranger Things did in a big way in the first season.
Right. Yeah. And so she was, she kind of was noticing those sort of things, where I've seen each of the seasons of Stranger Things once, but she was, you know, she is well versed. Like, she is watching it all the time, kind of a thing. And
I'm glad she dug it, because it's also one of those things where it's so funny to me that it's like there will be that degree of like the occasional like, well, a modern day kid watched this movie that I found frightening and it wasn't frightening anymore. So to do the math, when this movie came out in 1984, if you go back 35 years, which is how old the first Nightmare was, it was 1949. I imagined modern day kids in 1984 watching a horror movie from 1949 were probably not very scared either.
I like that. That's a really good point. I like that.
Whereas, like, the audiences in 1949, when those movies came out, like, or the older, like, Vincent Price, House on Haunted Hill, stuff like that, the audiences found that, like, terrifying.
Right, yeah. So that's good. I like that. So she also, you know, the Tina in the hall scene, she really liked that. And so there were scenes that she liked, but it wasn't a thing where she was – it wasn't like the 2018 Halloween where she was jumping she was laying on the ground on her stomach, and then she'd be standing, and then she'd be hiding in the corner, holding her, you know, covering her face, and just, you know, really having a good time, but a hard time, you know.
Totally, totally.
And so it was just a kind of a different reaction. And then my wife also brought up, she's like, really? She's like, I thought she would have been scared by that. I said, well, she wasn't really. And she said, well, part of the reason might be is that we watched it on a Friday, and my kiddo has like 2 hours of dance on Wednesdays, and she goes in early on Wednesdays also for orchestra practice. And then on Thursday morning, she has choir practice. And so she's got like her later half of the week, she is pretty wiped out. And so she's pretty numbed out by the time the end of the week gets here. And then, you know, the weekend, she gets to sleep in and gets to kind of reset, and then she's fine for the next week. But in that sort of last half of the week, she is probably a little dulled, I guess we'll say it that way.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
Yeah. So I was one of the things I was paying a little bit more close attention to this time, especially when it comes to the remake version, was I paid a little bit closer attention to the score in this watching. In this viewing, and I absolutely love it. Like the sort of Freddy little theme on the piano or whatever it was played on.
Well, because it's oddly, it always feels like it's the wrong note, which is kind of what makes it work. And yeah, it's like really kind of weird, creepy. So I got one of those few things I'll like kind of splurge for every once in a while is Mondo. They put out vinyl collections, and like 2 years ago they put out like the entire Nightmare on Elm Street scores on vinyl. So I picked those up. Yeah, the score by Charles Bernstein, who would go to do, I believe he also did he do a new Nightmare? He did not. Yeah, he only did a Nightmare on Elm Street. So it's kind of different than, but that theme, that like theme has stuck with the series, as opposed to like Friday the 13th. Mancini has been on that series all but Jason Takes Manhattan.
Yeah, so it feels like the same movie. You know, it's just like
there's a degree.
Yeah, that's no kidding. So yeah, I was really taken by the score that you hummed there, because I thought that was really particularly good. So I do want to talk a little bit about how when the sequel came out, they talked a little bit about how the original, they wanted this and they wanted that. What did you think? Because I read that Craven wanted it to look a little bit more like a burn victim than it ended up looking, than the original Freddy design ended up looking like, because he wanted it to be a little bit more realistic than he was, and then he would have wished to use the CGI that they were able to do sort of in the later in the remake. And I kind of, That's sort of wrong-headed sounding to me, because I love the look, the original look. I mean, I think it's hard not to growing up with that, that example. But the thing that really struck me as wrong was the CGI, because part of what I like about this film is seeing the behind the scenes of how they were able to get Tina up on the ceiling, how they were able to do the Johnny Depp thing.
It makes it feel
thing.
More tactile. It's like, yeah, because of the way it was done then. So that's sort of the thing about, like, because I've read that occasionally too with Kurt, but I think also the other things I've read too is like they did do some makeup tests where it looked far more real. And within those tests, it just kind of was more off-putting. And not in like a good horror way. So that's where they kind of pulled back and pulled back. And I think that's what kind of makes it work in the entire, and then again, this is looking at the franchise as a whole, is it kind of helped when then he went comedic. Whereas if he looked more real, I think there would have been a degree of like, this doesn't feel right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it just looks a little bit like, it looks like, I mean, a nightmare of a burned person.
Yes. And so I think that kind of then adds to the weird fantasy element of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, yeah, if he was like, oh, this is a very realistic burnt person, I think you'd be like, all right. And like, maybe there's a degree of like, that would have been artsy, but it might not have done it as well.
Yeah.
People might have been more like, well, I'm not having a good time.
Right. So in the sort of slasher genre, you know, you typically have the final girl. What do you think of Heather Langenkamp in this and revisiting her original performance?
I think she's great. I think she's much better in part three.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she's actually like really good. She feels like a realistic teen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's one of those things is like a lot of these movies sometimes like person felt like a really realistic teen. Some people did not. I think she did a good. And I think actually everyone in it feels like a good realistic teen. Like Tina, I think in any other slasher movie, and this is not to say anything of the actress, but they would have overdone her hair and her outfits and they would have made her like model hot and they would have really overdone how much Nancy was the girl next door and all this other stuff. And I feel like this film really strikes that perfect balance
mm-hmm.
of like, this is who this person is. This is who this person is. This is who Johnny Depp is. This is Tina's boyfriend. And you feel like you also get the vibe that, yeah, these three or four characters probably would spend time together. You're not sitting there going like, I don't buy it.
Yeah. And I do like how, you know, Glenn and Rod, they don't necessarily get along. I kind of like that.
Which also feels very real.
Yeah. To where it's, you know, it's like the girls are friends and the two boyfriends don't really get along kind of a group.
Yep, 100%.
And I'm kind of like, oh, that feels right. That feels real. Like I think that that's credited to the actors, but also to Wes Craven, who I don't necessarily automatically think of as being a wonderful writer for dialogue. Like that's not like the first thing I think of him when I think of Wes Craven. But I mean, I think it sounds for the time. I think it sounded exactly the way, like it's one of those where I didn't realize what a needle it had to thread until I watch other attempts.
And I think also, I think it's where, like, Wes Craven's work, I think is definitely, it's not all hits, but the ones that do hit pretty well are really hit.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, Nightmare, The Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left, as brutal as those films are, there is something that's, like, clearly really clicked into the zeitgeist. And also, you know, the guy, again, it's like, he could have done nothing but terrible films with the fact that the dude did create Freddy Krueger. It's like, well, there you go.
Yeah. I kind of really like Red Eye too. That's one of his later ones.
Red Eye is good. Red Eye, I don't think gets enough credit. I feel like I'm waiting for people to rediscover Red Eye, as it were.
Yeah. It's almost like, that since horror has got, I mean, I feel like it's got more and more popular in the mainstream that's one of those that's kind of ignored to where there's just so many titles.
Horror always will kind of come in waves. Horror, like, you know, you have like the old, I mean, not that it ever goes away, but as far as like how popular or accepted or anything like that, I think like it'll always kind of go in waves. Cause it's like you had, you know, the 80s, which was like the slasher boom and all these other kinds of things, but mainly the slasher boom. Then it all kind of dies off in like between like 89 to right before Screams comes out. There's a lot of great horror movies, but they're not really grabbing the zeitgeist or it's made by directors who are generally looked at as like, oh, they're past their prime. It's over. Yeah.
You know, so many sequels at that point too.
So many sequels. And then you get Scream. So that like revitalizes the teen slasher genre. And that goes, and then that sort of has like a 3-year big run. And then that kind of dies off. And then we get into the era of the
like Saw
mm-hmm. gore porn. But also that's also when all the remakes were being done.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that period of time, and then that dies off, and like, oh, the last Saw didn't do as well, and these didn't do as well, and we're kind of done with the remakes, and now you're getting the art house slash returning, which is like the Halloween, Black Christmas, but you're also now getting like Us and Get Out, and all. So we're in a very interesting time right now in that both horror movies are critically being very praised. These art house horror films are coming out, your Midsummers and stuff like that. And then that the old masters are returning, and those movies are also really well liked and doing very well. So, but also every genre, everything has like a bubble. So it's like, we're probably 2 or 3 years away from again, like, kind of tapers off, And then we'll see something new in 8 years.
I love it. And we also had the wave of with Ring with all of the Asian horror.
Oh yes, that was that's also the era within like the Saw remake genre.
Yeah. So yeah, this one is it's one of those where it's a little bit hard to talk about because it is, I feel like it is a horror classic. Like if it's one of those where, you know, with 2019 eyes, if you're being introduced to it to the first time and you're a kid, maybe you're not scared by it. But I think what I was glad that Anna was able to do was she watched it and enjoyed it just as a scary movie. Like it didn't necessarily scare her, but she enjoyed it just as a movie. It wasn't like, oh yeah, well, let's just skip to the deaths. Like I talked about on Friday the 13th a few episodes ago where, I showed her part 4 and I was like, oh man, this is a lot sexier than I remembered it. And so I just kept skipping bits. And then, so we ended up just watching the deaths and she's like, well, that was kind of gross. And ooh, that was weird. But she's like,
Whatever.
Yeah. She's just like, ooh, look at that one. And I was like, yeah, that's gross. And she's like, God, why are they all naked all the time? And I was like, well, you'll figure it out in a couple of years. You know, it's just,
you'll get it together. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. The only thing that she said about that is Tina and Rod are up in Tina's room.
Oh yeah.
And they're just howling away. Right. And so Anna's like, she just kind of sits there and wrinkles her nose a little bit. And then she's watching it and I'm watching her watch it. And then they cut to Rod being on top of her and she goes, oh, ew. It was just like, come on, movie. What is this? So yeah, that's kind of the main takeaway was, you know, the parents are great in this. Like I really like having John Saxon and his, doesn't really believe his daughter, but will kind of go along with it. And Ronnie Blakely. Well,
that's sort of the other thing that the Nightmare film did too, is like prior to that, like for the most part, if you look at like your Friday the 13th, your Halloween, stuff like that, even though like the sheriff character is in Halloween, there's Donald Pleasance. For the most part, the horror films of this era and a lot of horror films still today, the parents are slightly absentee. Like they're not there. Uh-huh. Like they're either never mentioned. Or there's like a quick scene, like if I think of Scream, Neve Campbell's dad is in the very beginning, you know, very briefly, and then that's it. And the parents are like never talked about. They're not really a presence.
Or there's some sort of catalyst, right, with mom being dead or whatever.
Yeah, they're usually so. But with Nightmare, the thing that I mean, Wes Craven's kind of talked about that, like for Nightmare was sort of like a big jambalaya of a bunch of kinds of things. And one of the things he was playing with was in the 80s. That was like the rise of divorced homes. And so, you know, you have like Spielberg the same year does E.T., which is like, oh, the dad left. Da, 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 we're going to talk about divorce. And a big thing that Wes Craven wanted to play with within Nightmare. And I think it's not something that's very clear, but once you hear it, you're like, oh, no, that totally makes sense. Is the idea that it's like you are a suburban kid and your parents have broken up and they're both to some extent trying their best. But by your parents actually trying to help you, they are actually hurting you. And that's like putting the bars on the door, the parents not believing, like all these different things where you're kind of like, oh, and playing with that whole idea of like the absentee parents who, though they are there, are not helping you.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. I like that. I like that because, yeah, and we'll talk about the remakes version of that. So I don't know. I was really pleased to sort of to check this out. The version that I watched, I guess I had a slightly different memory of it. So I got the I just had this individual title and it was from the library and it's got the full documentary. It's like a 2-disc deal. But the version that I watched, so Tina's up on the ceiling and she dies and then falls. And I guess the version in my memory was there was like a big splash of blood. And in this version, for whatever reason, didn't match my memory. It just, she hits the ground and then there's just like a little spray on Rod and that's it. Is that the same? Like, am I imagining something different?
No, it's always kind of like a little bit of a spray.
And that was it?
Yeah.
For some reason, I felt like she was landing in like this big pool of blood and there's blood everywhere or something. But so maybe I just am mixing that up with the fountain with Johnny Depp at the end.
Well, and that's sort of an interesting thing about that happens with horror movies is like There are so many movies. The famous one is Texas Chainsaw, where people have like real solid memories of like, I swear you could see the knife going into her back
right,
when
yeah.
Leatherface puts her on the hook. I swear. And then the filmmakers had to be like, no, we never filmed that.
Yeah, well, especially in 2019, I'm like, wait a minute, which cut did I watch? Did I watch this cut? I'm pretty sure I watched the PG cut.
Like something's amiss.
That's right. So it couldn't be my memory. It could be that, the fucking library got me this PG-13 version. So anyway, so anything about the original Nightmare on Elm Street before we move on to the dubious remake?
Not really. I mean, it holds up. I still think it's great. It's a movie I will watch every year around Halloween. I'll throw it on. It's comfort food. I think, like, if anyone is interested, the documentary and also the book Never Sleep Again, I think, are both like fantastic.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That
it
was
really
kind of
that... give you like a good idea of like the fact that the movie is as good as it is and considered a classic and how hard it was to make. And I mean, every movie's hard to make, but especially like indie horror films where every studio was like, this is stupid.
That's right. Well, especially, you know, in 84, when you're passed by all these major studios and it's like, well, what other options do you have then?
Yeah.
It's not like he's like, well, I'm just shooting it on my phone and I'm just putting it out. You know, that wasn't an option for Ole Wes.
No, so, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go ahead and move on to our second film. It is from 2010, and it is the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street. The IMDb plot synopsis for this one is less verbose, but equally as ridiculous.
Go.
So it goes like this. Death stalks the dreams of several young adults to claim its revenge on the killing of Freddy Krueger. That is quite a sentence. Chased and chastised by this finger-bladed demon, it is the awakening of old memories and the denials of a past of retribution. Okay. It is the awakening of old memories and the denials of a past of retribution that spurns this hellish vision of a dreamlike state and turns death into a nightmare reality. What a fucking word soup that
there it
is.
There it all
is. Wow. It's like, I'm just going to put all of these words and I'm just going to hit randomize. So, Cameron, tell me about your experience with A Nightmare on Elm Street. Did you go to the theater to see this?
Went to not just the theater. I went to the midnight screening. I was excited for this one because here's the thing. It's like, it looked like after Freddy versus Jason, it was done. We were all wrapped up on Robert Englund doing Freddy, and that was always such a bummer. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, hey, if we're going to do it, there's maybe interesting ways to do it. And I will say, I stand by, I think the trailers are pretty well done. The trailers for this film really do give it this simultaneous, like, holy crap vibe, while also, like, building up an anticipation. You know what I mean? Like, the trailers are very well cut.
Well, and I would say that the trailers are better than the movie.
Yeah, Jackie Earle Haley, I was kind of excited when he got cast. I was like, okay, that's an interesting choice, because I really loved not just Rorschach, but also him in Little Children.
Little Children, was, yeah, playing a child molester, yeah.
Playing, yeah, I thought he was fantastic in Little Children. So there was a lot that I was really, 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 really excited for this film. And I remember going, and it was the kind of a classic case of, like, going and kind of talking myself into thinking, like, I think that was okay. I think it was all right. You know, and it got so shatted on. I remember it getting so shit on when it came out. And I was just like, man, I don't know. And also, too, this is the other thing, too, is, like, taking out Freddy versus Jason, my other thing with this film was the fact that the last couple straight up Robert Englund films were not real great. Mm-hmm. Not because of Robert Englund, he's doing his best, but like I think Freddy's Dead is real, real rough for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not the biggest fan of Freddy's Dead. Even the part five, The Nightmare Child, has some cool imagery, but it's still just also kind of like bleh in there. So part of me was like, well, I think it's a little bit better than, you know, these other films. But I haven't really gone back and rewatched it since then. And this was not, thankfully, this is not the case of like me really beating the drum and telling people, no, you're all crazy. It's great. Yeah, it's
you
great.
Guys you guys don't get it.
Yeah, this is always just me going like, oh, that was all right. I don't know. And rewatching this, I will say this. It's better than like The Fog.
Ooh.
And some of the other remakes.
Put that on
came
the poster.
Out.
It's better than The Fog, Cameron Rice.
I think it's better than The Fog. I think it's better than a couple other little things. At the same time, though, this falls perfectly within the middle, which makes it perfectly bland.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that...
I think the positives, I think Jackie Earle Haley has some cool stuff he does. I think he actually isn't too bad. I like Clancy Brown. I like seeing Clancy Brown.
I could always have time for Clancy Brown. That's right.
Yeah, all for Clancy Brown. But then outside of that, I think the young cast, Rooney Mara, I think is actually a pretty good Nancy, a modern day Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
I think she actually does a pretty damn good job. And the one idea that they introduced that I thought was pretty good was the idea that even though you're dead, your unconscious mind can live for hours.
Mm, yeah.
And I remember finding that like very haunting. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, that's pretty good. And the idea of, that they are so exhausted that they're kind of going in and out of sleep. So Freddy's constantly almost getting them, even when they're in public and all this other stuff. So there's little ideas, there's elements that I was like, I kind of dig that. I dig that. I think that kind of, they actually pulled that off. They pulled that off. The biggest thing that makes it not work in the end is, I will say, I remember being kind of a big deal that the director, was from Nirvana. It was a big old deal. And it was a big old deal, that it was like, oh my God, it's the guy who did, Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's his first movie. How's this going to go? Man, you could have told me this was directed by a music video director, who had just done the most recent Mountain Dew commercial. Nothing stood out to me.
Yeah,
it wasn't really a standout moment visually in this film. You do now have like all the CG and the blah, 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 all the new technology. Imagine the nightmares and so on and so forth. Blah, 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 blah. This was pretty boring.
Yeah. So I think part of the problem is that it looks like someone that sort of knows what they're doing, and it has some instances of CGI that are pretty decent, but then it just has no sort of like, you know how you mentioned that Wes Craven had the script for years before it came out? This doesn't feel like it's anyone's passion project. This doesn't
it was the next thing. We already did Friday the 13th. We've done the Amityville Horror's out and this and the other. What's next? Oh, I guess we'll get to Freddy. He's here.
Yeah. Hey, we got that property. Let's just go ahead and make this, I guess. Is what it felt like. And I was just like, well, what the hell? Some of the things that I had, and you're, of course, going to be the one who answers the questions, right? Because I always write down questions in my notes, and then Cameron gets to try to answer them, because of course he would know. But some of the things that I was curious about was, you know, I had just mentioned that I paid close attention to the score in the first film, in the original. Why do you think they kind of went away from some of that classical music? Because I didn't hear it as prominent as I wanted to.
Let me tell you, horror movie scores, like, we are in a golden era right now. Like, It Follows is so good. Mm. The scores to Midsommar, like, there are some great, great horror movie scores. The stuff that was happening around this time, the remake scores and everything, were so... it goes with the movies. They were bland as hell.
Yeah, just very vanilla. Just, I didn't get it at all. Like, it was like, I couldn't even.
Unique motifs. There's no like continuous theme throughout the thing. Like, I think the most through all the horror that was coming out this year, I think the only thing that ever stood out was maybe what's now called like the Saw theme, the Hello Zip. Mm-hmm. Like, that was used in a lot of things. But outside of that, like, there was not really like a standout horror thing in this 10-year period.
Yeah.
As far as score goes.
Sure, I can see that. I can see that, because my first question was, why go away from the classic sound? Like, why turn your back to the thing? If you're remaking the movie, why not use that in some way, which they did so successfully in the 2018 Halloween, right? And I guess it helps having John Carpenter be a part of it.
Didn't hurt.
But and so that was one of the first questions I had. I thought that so this is a little behind the podcast, but so Rachel and I are still working through our YA franchise theme, and so we're in the middle of Twilight as of recording, and so we have Kellan Lutz, who is in Twilight, and he's Dean in this at the very beginning. And Dean is the no sleeping jock that we have Katie Cassidy as Chris, who she consoles at the very beginning. And my first note was, this fucking Dean guy, who is this? He's terrible. And then I looked him up and was like, oh, he's a Twilight guy, of course.
Well, I mean, listen, like, Twilight, there's a lot of great actors in Twilight.
Absolutely,
no,
there are.
No one
yeah.
looked good. No one looked good.
Absolutely. And so this whole beginning scene, I was like, okay, so this is your chance to put your own stamp on this remake, right? Because this is not a direct rip from the beginning. This is something different. So this is either Wesley Strick or Eric Heiserer or Samuel Bayer or whoever. This is their chance to do something fresh.
Yeah, I mean, it could be whoever, because that's the other thing, too. It's like, it's worth noting, like, man, sometimes the credited screenwriters were not responsible for the worst ideas.
Right. And that's what they said is, you know, in different interviews, they talk about, well, none of this looked at all like the draft that I turned in and that kind of thing. And yeah. Some of that I'm like, well, is that true? Or is that because it got, you know, it got torn up through the critics and the audience responses that you just don't, you kind of want to disassociate yourself and you see a lane to where you can do that or what? But anyway, so we had that in there, and we've got Dean being just terrible. I was like, God, this is such a rough performance. This is not giving me any sort of faith in Samuel Bayer and his skill at directing actors. And then we get the introduction of Rooney Mara, and I was like, you know, we have the very 2010 Kyle Gallner, right, as Quentin. And I was like, this completely sums up like the early 2000s as this actor, because I haven't seen him since, at least to my knowledge. But I felt like in this era, either the late 90s or the early 2000s, I felt like I saw his very punchable face all the time. And I was like, God, I recognize this guy. And I've seen this before. I didn't mention that, but I've seen this before. And so rewatching it this time, it's like, okay, well, maybe I was really hard on it, because on Netflix, I think I either gave it a 1 or a 2. And so I was like, well, maybe I was just rough on it. And I was like, oh, man, this what an absolute curse to be accused of being Rooney Mara's boyfriend. Right. Because the guys at the table are all giving him shit. They're like, oh, hey, there's your girlfriend. Better ask her out. There's your girlfriend. And I'm like, what the fuck? And you know, Nancy in the interviews, Rooney Mara talks about how Nancy is socially awkward and timid And I was like, what? Because in this conversation, she talks about how she's used to jerk customers. And I was like, you don't really get to be that socially awkward and timid if you're working at this kind of sleazy diner and you have to put up with all this bullshit all the time. I was like, that is not true. And, you know,
I don't know. There's some waitresses.
Well, I was like, I have some biases because with my wife being, you know, being in HR, but also serving and bartending most nights. Like, she has to deal with a lot of stuff, and I would not classify her as socially awkward and timid, but she's
right.
comes across in the same, you know, she has to deal with the same sort of shit that Rooney Mara is dealing with, it seems like. So I just have never would have put socially awkward onto this Nancy Holbrook, as they renamed the character in this version. I didn't pick up on that really at all. I did think that they had a pretty good Dean death, though.
That's the thing. It's like this movie, for every like thing that is so boring and dumb, there's like one or two things where you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. But the problem is, he was like that makes it more frustrating.
Yeah, really. And so, you know, he gets the sort of the shoulder to shoulder, or like from, you know, basically around his clavicle, and he gets his whole throat slit. And I was like, whoa, like that's pretty good. Like that's a really good death, actually. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe this first scene is just kind of rough and we'll move on from here. And then, Cameron, we kind of get to a little bit of this middle ground of the film where it's like, well, wait a minute, who is the main character? Because we spend a lot of time with Chris, with Katie Cassidy's character. And I was like, well,
we spent a lot of time with her. And also, like, we got, I think to me, the main thing and the main maybe issue of this movie to some extent is the introductory idea that I'm trying to think about it, but the introductory idea that essentially Freddy Krueger might not have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly. That the parents might have messed up. And here's the thing, as an idea, as a quick little like aside thing, not terrible. It's not the worst thing ever. It's kind of like, oh, okay, but you know, hey, you're doing something different. We always want, you know. Think about remakes, we always like hit the drum of like, you know, hey, do something kind of different. Don't just do the same shit over and over again. Give us something new. Give us something new. So I'm like, hey, at least they kind of tried that, but they spend so much time on it. And at the same time, it's also like, I don't know why, because we know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not going to suddenly surprise us with a new answer. You know, like the idea that it's like, and that would only work if you introduced it in the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Not after we've already seen him brutally murder a bunch of people and exactly. then ask us to be sympathetic for him. It doesn't click.
Yes, yes. I put Freddy's history confuses the sympathies, right? Because yeah. you see him playing with the kids and he's kind of playing with them fairly genuinely. And you're like, well, maybe Jackie Earle Haley is playing this like victim, you know, and he's and so then you're like, no, that's all bullshit. He really did all this stuff. And you're like, well, what the fuck did you waste my time then? It's like, that's a really good idea, I felt like, if this was a miniseries. Not if this is a two-hour right. movie or an hour and 35-minute movie that you're trying to squeeze all that into. And you're spending a good, like, 25, 30 minutes of it.
Agree. And it's also the thing, too, is, like, there's the idea that it's like, so this kind of goes with, like, what we're talking about, what, you know, do not make Freddy look like a real burn victim mm-hmm, in the original mm-hmm. film. So you do, and I think that along with that, the original series never bluntly says he molested the kids.
It's exactly.
very, very hinted at. It's very much like, of course he did. It's super hinted at and all this other stuff, but they never blatantly say it. He's always the child killer. So they always called the child killer. So it's like, he's the child killer. His burns are more, you know, make a bee and fantastical. So then this film, you make it super realistic and you make it very blunt that it's like, no, yeah, child molester. He did it. He molested mm-hmm. these kids. Here's Polaroids of their like bodies and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And there's something about it that makes you just go, ugh. Yeah. Like it just feels in a weird way. I for lack of a better word, like inappropriate for then the movie to be this blandly glossy.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're going to really go for it with some of this stuff, you know, this is where we talk about with stuff like the original Evil Dead, where it's like part of that movie's thing is also the fact that it looks so grimy and cheap. And when you go super glossy and make it look really good, and then that's what's happening, it feels like a disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what happens here is like, okay, you decide to go for it, make him look like a real burn victim. And you decide to go for it and really blatantly say, yeah, he molested the kids. So it's like you have all that. And then it's super glossy and really CG and all this other stuff. So it just feels like there is a disconnect between the movie you are trying to make.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was one of the things that I think that I had a problem with way back in the day when we talked about the remake of Evil Dead with Fede Alvarez's Evil Dead, which I absolutely fucking hated. And it's one of those where it's like, well, maybe I kind of feel like watching that again. Unlike our RoboCop discussion, which is another movie that I fucking hated the remake of. But anyway, to where that Fede Alvarez one is you're taking a very dirty, grimy sort of low budget film, and then you're just putting all the sheen on it. And I just didn't give a shit.
At least with the Evil Dead one, they went full bore with the blood.
They did.
It was not CG. Yeah. They got like, they dunk those actors in blood. So there's a degree of like, well, that's good. You went for it this way.
Yeah,
so that kind of worked.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like a lot of these horror remakes that came out that really, I mean, really the only thing that makes this not PG-13, this Nightmare on Elm Street remake, is the CG blood.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have that, it just feels like it's a PG-13, like The Fog.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What do you think about, because I think one of the iconic moments from the first film is Tina's death, right? Like, I think that that's one that people remember through and through, is Tina dying with the walls and the ceiling and all that. What do you think of the remake of this? Because for me, it felt like she was just kind of banging around the walls for a while. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, she's just kind of like...
Yeah, again, it's similar where it's like the problem with... And obviously, like, I'm not an anti-CG guy. If CG is needed and it works, then good, it works. But the thing about – there's always something to – if it's – I always go to, like, a Tim Burton as a director. You know, like, there's a lot of issues with Tim Burton's modern-day movies. But part of the fun about the original early-day Tim Burton movies is because it came from animation. So there was stop motion and animation, all this other stuff. There's something tactile. There's something about, oh, somebody made this, you know. Mm-hmm. Anton first had to go design this giant Gotham City that then had to be put in Pinewood Studios. Someone built that. It's wood. There's all this other stuff. And there's something that even if the effects don't hold up, it's charming. You know someone made that. You know someone with their bare hands had to make this thing. CG, as it ages, does not have charm to it.
Yeah.
The Mummy Returns does not have charm to it. The Mortal Kombat with Reptile being a CG character does not have charm to it.
What and about so I Spawn? Think, what do you think that one's good?
Oh, for a man, the hell that is in Spawn is my
straight
god.
Straight out of N64.
Oh man, but and I think that's sort of the thing here is like obviously it's not that these CG effects are bad, but the fact that it's like the original one, 1984, it's on the cheap, so there's a degree of like you know they had to like rig this thing up. Really get this actress. It feels real. It feels like when she's about to like hit Rod that they really had to kind of plan it out because these actors were pretty close to each other. They had to get the shot.
Yeah.
And in this, it just feels it's very ping pong ball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in that original, you're like, all right, if we don't get it, look, we're going to have to clean this fucking set and then you're going to have to do this again.
Yeah.
You know, like you're going to have to do all this shit again if you don't get it. There is no getting it in the CGI world. Like, we'll just keep tweaking away until we're satisfied with how it looks. So just whatever you got practical is just going to work.
Yeah. So it ends up just kind of being blah. And the fact that it's like, you know, there's never been a sequel, even though this movie did well.
Yeah. It did a lot of money. And that was fun. That was funny that you mentioned the midnight screening because it did a lot of money in that midnight screening.
Yeah. I think people are genuinely very excited for it.
Yeah. Well, it's been almost 10 years. I mean, it's almost due for another go, right? Like every 10 years or so.
Well, I feel like it's so funny. I feel like the studio, it's the same with Friday the 13th. I feel like because Warner Brothers now owns the rights to these.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because Warner Brothers bought New Line. So Warner Brothers now owns the rights to this. Paramount has Friday the 13th again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's they a have big mess back. Of that, right? Like, isn't there a big mess between the between Sean Cunningham and the original writer and... Because I thought for a while there was like a 2017, they were going to remake Friday the 13th in 2017. And we'll talk about this next episode, but there was supposedly a 2017 version that was going to come out, and then they had more legal issues again.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like with all these like franchises, the fact of the matter is like movie studios now, and this is sort of the problem with like movie studios we're seeing it with the Disney Fox thing. It's like if movie studios buy all the films – you know, and all the different studios and like, oh, this is a little studio. Well, now I got bought by a big studio and this and the other, blah, blah, blah. Well, now the thing you have happen is every studio is only interested in making $1 billion a picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't give
matter.
Me the, yeah, don't give me this small budget shit. I want to make $1 billion.
I want to make $1 billion with every movie. So it doesn't matter that to make a new Nightmare on Elm Street would cost 25, and they'd probably make 100 million. So therefore, even if you double for, you know,
for marketing and all that,
and advertising and all that other stuff, even if you did all that, you would still walk away with like, oh, hey, you know, we made $50 million. That's a profit. They don't work like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the only place that is doing that is Blumhouse, right? Because yes. Blumhouse's model is let's spend $20 million on 10 different movies, and then if one of them pops huge, then that'll pay for all next year's other 10 or whatever.
Yes, and so that's sort of the thing. So then so that's why it's like Warner Brothers owns Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really necessarily, and that's not to say Warner Brothers doesn't also still make horror movies. They did It. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like Warner Brothers did It. They did the Conjuring movies. Like that's what they're doing. And I feel like the only way you're going to see a new Nightmare is if the producers of the Conjuring films want to make a new Nightmare.
Oh yeah, like if James Wan says, "Hey, here's my new deal. Done, done. We're doing it."
Yeah, I feel like outside of that though, like they're far more interested in Harry Potter and the DC films and all this other stuff. That it's like it doesn't make financial sense to make a $10 million Nightmare on Elm Street movie that's going to be R-rated, that teenagers are not going to go to, that the horror fans will be upset if it is PG-13 so that the teenagers can go and all this other stuff. It's just like, well, let's just keep like we'll just kind of keep putting out every once in a while, oh, we're exploring the idea of a new Nightmare on Elm Street. We're looking into it.
Yeah, it's one of those where I feel like James Wan could do it. I feel like depending on how Dr. Sleep ends up coming out, I think that Mike Flanagan could do it. It's one of those, it's like if that's what they decide to do, that those sort of directors could push it through towards like, hey, here's what we're doing.
And I think that's the thing. And I think, you know, sometimes it just takes the right thing to hit in the right way. Like, obviously, like, I'll be honest, the fact that Halloween did as well as it did, I was kind of surprised we didn't hear more about,
slashers. Yeah.
Like the return of other slashers. It's like Black Christmas was sort of the one. Like, I truly was like very surprised we did not hear, oh, you know what? Hey, guess what? This is happening. We're doing it. Oh, this is we're doing it. We're doing Friday the 13th. It's coming back. Oh, Nightmare's coming back. I guess possibly the only reason is like, did they not have a young director who was interested? And also the fact that Wes Craven has since passed away.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Well,
so they can't really.
They did talk about how Samuel Bayer had been courted to do several movies before he finally agreed to do this one. And
sort of the thing. It's like, why?
Yeah, one of them was the Nightmare remake. Or not Nightmare remake, the Friday the 13th remake.
Yeah.
And they wanted him to do that, and they said no. And then it was finally a big, long, detailed email, supposedly, from Michael Bay. This is from Platinum Dunes, from Michael Bay, that said, hey, here's why you need to do this, because this will open up opportunities for your career and blah, blah, blah. And Samuel Bayer hasn't done another movie since. So
I know. Isn't that the wildest thing?
That's weird. That is kind of weird because I wouldn't think that it's like it doesn't come across as incompetent or anything. I will say that, you know, you never know what's going on behind the scenes. But Rooney Mara said in an interview that this was such a bad experience that she considered quitting acting.
Right.
After making this movie. So I was like, well, that's not real singing praise from an actress that has become, you know, a very solid actress since this film.
Oh, yeah. And so there's a lot of elements to that. And also, I will say, because I can easily see some people going like, well, of course, you know, how could we not think it was going to be bad? It was Michael Bay's Platinum Dunes, this and the other. Platinum Dunes made A Quiet Place.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't have any problem with if your production company is taking something over. A lot of the times for me, that just means that's the people that are pouring the money in. Like a director's vision or a screenwriter's vision or whoever or the producer or whatever. That to me is like if you have a real strong director opinion or if a script is coming in and it's pristine in what it's trying to do, that can sing through some producer that's, you know, trying to oversee and say, hey, we gave you 30% of the budget for this, so now we want you to change blah, blah, blah. I mean, a lot of it just strikes me as like, I want to be the person in the editing room going through all this footage. It's what I want to do. Like, God,
no joke.
What I wouldn't give to be just in the editing room just to see, like, wait a minute, why are you doing this choice? Like, this is not good. Do this. Like, you have this footage, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't know. What do you think of getting back to the actual film? What do you think about you liked the micro dreams? Is that right?
I like the idea of them. I wouldn't say any of them stood out as far as like, oh, what a killer scene. But the idea of it, I was like, yeah, you know, I kind of dig that.
Yeah, I think what I didn't like about them as much, because I think you're right with the idea of them is interesting, is that I liked that Nancy would have to find ways to hurt herself in the dream to wake herself up. And then here they had Rooney Mara's character use the cigarette lighter in the car to keep herself awake. And I was like, well, that's not really the same. Like, that's not what it is. Like, that's not the thing. And then we went away a little bit from the, you know, there's no church in this. And I always am a sucker for any sort of religious anything, right? Where it's like, oh no, hey, this is a demon from blah, blah, blah. And you know, you've got to have the, you got to have this or that that's a religious symbol or else it's going to get you. And I'm like, ooh, yeah, okay, maybe that's true. You know, I buy into that more. And they didn't bother with any of that this time around.
Yeah, no.
and then finally, what do you think about the parents in this? Because we have Connie Britton, who you've got to make sense for Connie Britton being in it. So you got to have her in it. But they kind of like were in it.
I love Connie Britton. They gave them like really nothing to do.
I know they didn't have them do much, but I was like, why are, like, what is the point here? Like, why are they're really sort of helpful. And in the original movie, they weren't helpful.
Yeah. Yep.
And so that didn't make any sense to me.
There's a number of things that just like, yeah, it just does not, it doesn't gel. It just doesn't all gel.
Yeah, and so Cameron, I think you'll agree with this. My final note was, wow, what a nothing. Right? Like, it's not incompetently made. It's not an absolute failure. It is just so blah, medium, you know, sort of factory feeling to where there's no voice.
Which is the worst. I mean, that's sort of the worst, is like the whole, just the whole blah of it all. It's just like, why? Why did this happen?
Yeah, why bother then? If you're going to make it be like this, because, you know, they had some things where they were recreating the original and they had some things that were new. And I was like, okay, well, ideally that would be interesting because you got the bathtub scene and that's pretty, you know, at the beginning, it's pretty much the same, but then she doesn't get sucked down into the bath, into the water. I'm like, oh, okay, well, they're doing it a little bit different. And so I can see why some of that might be interesting, but then I don't know. I was just like sort of nonplussed by the whole thing. And again, that is the worst sort of thing that you could get from a remake, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's like, again, it's telling that it's like this didn't seem to jumpstart anything for anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody from the movie, like Kyle Gallner, like I said, is a guy that was from the 90s, late 90s and early 2000s. And I don't remember seeing him again. Rooney Mara didn't exactly get films made after this or something. You know, it wasn't a thing where she was like, oh, hey.
No, it was Dragon Tattoo. Dragon Tattoo did that for
yeah,
her.
Yeah, yeah. And Katie Cassidy, I mean, she was in other horror stuff, but
Arrow. It ended up being Arrow that helped her.
Yeah. And so, you know, she was in Stranger Calls, I think is one of the other things that she was in. And so it's like, well, I don't know. Like, you know, I'm sure thankful for the work, but it's like that wasn't really a deal that really panned out for her either.
No. Yeah, no. So,
I don't know. Well, I guess the last thing, what do you think about, what did you think about the look of Jackie Earle Haley with the sort of, I guess I sort of thought it was like a reptilian sort of mouth that he had. That was the only thing that I didn't necessarily like.
I think at the time I was kind of like, okay, hey, that's cool. That's different. And then as I get older, I'm like, you know, it's a nice difference. Not good. I mean, it didn't need to look exactly like Robert Englund.
Mm-hmm.
You could have done something different. And I don't know. It's fine. I think that's the thing. It's like at the end of the day, I feel like everyone, we all just walk away from this movie going like, it's fine. Oh, it's fine.
It's big sigh. Fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. You know, whatever.
Another poster quote from Cameron.
Yeah.
I like it. All right. Well, anything else about the original or the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street that we missed?
I think the original is great. I think it's a classic for a reason. It holds up. I think everything that you could say about the original, to some extent, has probably been said. And if they, I don't know, if they were announced tomorrow, like, hey, we're doing a new one. To me, like, with the whole people returning to the franchise, like, I don't know, dude, at the end of the day, like, I know Robert Englund put in his work. If he has no interest of ever doing Freddy again, he's completely over it.
Mm-hmm.
More power to him, 100%. Got it. That said, like, man, I would love the announcement that it's like, hey, we're doing it, and Robert Englund's back as Freddy.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about the fucking continuity of Freddy's dead and all this other stuff, blah, blah, blah. We're just dropping you into a story.
Yeah, we're doing it straight up Halloween style. It's, yeah. You know, it's Heather
Langenkamp.
Well,
I don't even do Halloween. Like, I don't think you need Nancy back. I don't think you need – I don't – like, my biggest thing is I'm like, to me, it's a similar thing with, like, the Alien franchise. I'm like, you know what? Just – it's not that it's comic books, but there is a degree of, like, you know what? Just drop us into a story.
Yeah, start us wherever you want to start us. And just
yeah,
tell
we don't need
story.
To worry about the continuity of like, well, this character. I'm like, no, you could just put us here. That's fine.
Yeah, I think ultimately the main thing is not worrying about the continuity of it, is just telling a good story, right? Like,
yeah,
whatever your story is in the Nightmare world, go ahead and tell that.
Yeah,
it'll be fine. Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be fine because, you know, no matter how old Robert Englund is, it would still work in this Nightmare world, right? Like, it doesn't, it's not like he needs to be like freaking 20 and a gymnast or something to play this character, you know? And so I think that, I mean, I would love that. I would love to see a new Nightmare that would be, you know, hey, I saw what they did in the first attempt, but, you know, we're going to tell this interesting story and we're going to go back to what worked. And I think that would be 100%. Plenty interesting. And if they wanted to make him completely horrifying, I'm okay with that. If they wanted to make it more comedic and they thought that they could pull it off, I'm okay with that too.
Yep. I agree.
I don't know. It just seems like, you know, sometimes in this version, they had a little bit of, they tried to do it a little bit of both, where Jackie Earle Haley had like the talk about a wet dream and stuff like that. And he had his, They didn't use the "this is God" thing that I thought that they had completely set up.
No, they did not. Yeah,
you know, they had it set up completely. They said, she says, let's see, I got it right here. She goes, "Oh God, what do you want from me?" And he goes, "There's no God, just me." And I'm like, "Oh no!"
Yeah, you know, hey,
why not use it?
What a swerve!
Why not use it? I don't know. It's not like more people would go see the movie or make more from having that line in there, but I wanted
But no,
it.
And I agree with you. It's like, what? Okay, then I guess. Got it, I think.
Yeah, really. So, all right. Well, I think that concludes our look at the remake. If you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle's @plainlabelpod. You can also follow me over there. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page and an account over at Instagram. Just search for Plain Label Podcast and you'll find us. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could check out our show notes, where you'll find the link to our Amazon wish list, where you can purchase some stuff like a, what did I put on there? Oh, I put on there yesterday a Jason Voorhees from the part 7 figurine. Nice. That you can get me. Yeah, I thought that was something that someone could buy me, that maybe I don't want to spend the money on, but somebody could buy it for me if they want to.
Yeah, like, yeah, go to town, you know.
Yeah, so I do want to thank Cameron from coming on. If people wanted to hear more from you or see you or get in touch with you, where could they do that?
Best way, Twitter @TheCameronRice. Same thing on Instagram. Also, Cam Rice Photo, my photo stuff. And then also go check out the show I'm on, El Rey Nation, from the El Rey Network. You can go check that out on iTunes or Amazon Prime.
Awesome. So thank you for listening. And you can join us next week when Cameron and I discuss the original and the remake of Friday the 13th.
Here we go.